Liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, willkommen zu unserem Podcast aus dem Kampnagel-Programmteam. Mein Name ist Amelie Deuffelhardt, ich bin die Intendantin von Kampnagel. In Zeiten des Shutdowns wollen wir Sie auf dem Laufenden halten über die Aktivitäten unserer lokalen und internationalen Künstlerinnen, Aktivistinnen und Denkerinnen. Gemeinsam mit uns fordern Sie im Kleinen wie im Großen solidarisches Handeln in Zeiten der Pandemie. Lassen Sie uns in Kontakt bleiben.
Hello and welcome to the third edition of our Kampnagel podcast Stay in Touch. My name is Uta Lambert and I've been working as a curator and dramaturg at Kampnagel for almost 10 years now. Right now we are witnessing a situation which nobody of us could have imagined only a few months ago. We at Kampnagel don't only mourn the temporary loss for our means to do what we can do best, which is creating live events, concerts, parties and social gatherings. Together with our artists, we are also figuring out day by day what it means to be cut off in this way. We are searching for new forms of expression, of gathering, protest and togetherness. And in order to do so, we think it's absolutely necessary to stay connected with our international artists. When we were brainstorming the guest list for this podcast, my colleague Alina suggested to invite Alok from New York City. And to be honest, I could not have imagined a more inspiring figure to share their perspectives on the public life and their approaches to navigate through this crisis. Alok is a gender non-conforming writer, performance and mixed media artist who uses poetry, comedy, performance, lecture, drag, sound art, fashion design, self-portraiture and social media to explore themes like gender, race, trauma, belonging and the human condition. We've been following their work for a long time and never lost contact. For the first time, they were at Kampnagel as part of the performance duo Dark Matter in May 2016 with their show It Gets Bitter. In June 2017, Alok hosted the workshop This World Might Be Ending, I'm Sorry, I Love You, in the framework of Danny Benani's School of Uncool. An intense exchange with the participants about hope, bonding and loneliness in an imaginary apocalypse. And with this being said, we are already in the middle of the discussion with Alok, who agreed to speaking with us from their home in Texas today. So Alok, first things first, how are you doing and how does the corona situation affect you personally and professionally right now?
I feel like my mood shifts a lot day to day. There are some days that I'm feeling like incredibly hopeful and excited by how everyone is seeing how fucked up the world is and is like really committed to changing it and dreaming in more expansive ways. And then there are days and hours even that I'm so upset. I mean, I just read the news and I hear how in states like Georgia and the United States, they're planning on opening up theaters again and restaurants, and there's just a complete disregard for any medical or scientific knowledge here, and that's seen as patriotism, and that's terrifying. There are days where I feel so much gratitude for how people are speaking about mental health and pain and death, things that I've written about in my work for so long that are now being publicly discussed. And then there are days that I feel deeply sad that so many people are dying and their lives aren't being commemorated. The virus has really affected me professionally because as a live performance artist, I can no longer do that kind of work. So I had all of my public engagements canceled for the foreseeable future, which was really difficult because I think for me and my mental health, performance is so integral to how I survive. So at first, I think I was mourning that for the first few weeks. And then I started to think, how can I continue to do my art in these times? And I'm still figuring that out, but I feel less bleak than before.
In your last workshop at Kampnagel, which happened in 2017, you asked the participants to imagine the apocalypse to come. You asked them to think about themselves as the last surviving human beings on Earth. How would they deal with the loss of their homes, the loss of their friends and their families, how would they support each other as part of a group of strangers who happened to find themselves together in a safe space when the catastrophe arrived? And would they take time to mourn their losses? Would they find strength to imagine a new future together? And if so, what would this future look like? In these times of the global pandemic, your hypothetical scenario suddenly became very close to our reality. How would you describe the situation in Texas, where you are based right now? What are your observations of the public life and social relations regarding the key questions this workshop opened up 3 years ago?
You know, I still think about that workshop all the time, because I've done that in several places, but the one that we did at Kampnagel was by far the most intense and the longest. I think we spent like 5 or 6 hours. It just like kept going. And it was thrilling. Like, it was really such a dynamic time because people really got into it, and it felt less like we were role-playing and more like it was very real. You know, I started that workshop because I really had been thinking a lot about art as a medium to process and strategize for crisis. In times of crisis, oftentimes it's art which is seen as non-essential or gratuitous. And I wanted to push back against that and actually say, art creates the spaces where we can have conversations that we wouldn't normally have. And especially conversations about death and belonging and trauma and future. And at first I was doing that out of a commitment to experimental theater. And that commitment looks like what seems surreal and what seems strange might actually be more real than the world, which is actually strange and surreal. And I think what experimental theater holds a mirror to the world and says, am I performing or are you? But now experimental theater has actually yielded what is the world. The world feels like theater now. Like when I watch the news, I'm just like, oh my gosh, we're living in a time where my president is supporting protesters against the government. Like, what? And it's just like, there's characters and they have scripts and things are very, it feels like a very strange play. But I think I'm able to navigate that better because so many people are like, this is so surreal. Like, it's like we're in a movie. And I'm like, absolutely, fiction is a modality to exist in the world. It's not something separate from reality. It's an integral part of reality. And so that's why I think artists are uniquely equipped to navigate these times, because we've been living in the surreal for a very long time. And I think the way that that influences how I'm showing up in this time and the space is I'm having to do a lot of reconsideration of the things that I believed were most transformative, dear, and wonderful. For years in my life and my career, I made an argument that showing up together and co-presence was one of the most beautiful and powerful things. And now showing up together is one of the most lethal and dangerous things. For a long, long time in my career, I believed in the power of intergenerational connection, that we had to have older folks and younger people together to really have real knowledge. Now that's a lethal form of intimacy. So many of the things that I believed were just and beautiful are now dangerous, like looking at each other in the face and being close to each other now can be a form of transmission, like sharing food, sharing utensils, sharing just property now can be a form of illness. And so in response to that, you're seeing the kind of reentrenchment of heteronormativity, of private property, of mine and yours, the designation of spaces like territories, and a deep kind of hostility to any kind of infringement. any kind of intimacy is seen as now infringement. And so that's been really hard for me because I'm having to relearn so many of the things that I believe, so many of the social choreographies that I believed were beautiful and right. And I'm having to kind of relearn a new script and a new dance on how to live with the world. And I don't think it's about actually replacing what we had. Like, I think that one of the ways that we're tripping up is we're trying to use Zoom and we're trying to use the internet to do the same things that we were doing. I actually think it's now about creating alternative ways to relate, not replacing, but creating alternative. And at first, it feels like those alternative ways are not as good or not as fulfilling. But then you realize you can't compare, it's your own thing. And I think this is something queer people know really well. It's not that our femininity is the same thing as straight femininity, it's something else. It's not that our masculinity is the same thing as straight masculinity, it's something else. We develop new ways of existing that are undecipherable by the mainstream kind of gaze. And so I think I really committed at this point, once again, to that experimental tradition and to remind other artists, like, at first it's going to feel ridiculous. We're going to be like, why am I just speaking onto the screen? Like, oh my God. But then we need to get over that and actually commit ourselves to developing new forms of intimacy. So one of the things that I've been doing is I've been assembling grief workshops with strangers. And what I'm finding is that online, people are actually willing to be more vulnerable than they would in person, because there's something about the kind of anonymity of the internet while also being seen in it that allows people to not have to see people's immediate reaction, which is allowing them to divulge more about their lives. And so I've been really uplifting that, being like, whoa, how can we use technology as a conduit for intimacy? And actually after Camp Nagel in 2017, I worked on a show called Watching You Watch Me that I made at an art institution in Italy, and I toured for the next year. And in that show, what I was really trying to work through, and I did it in Berlin in 2017, later that summer actually. What I was really trying to work through in that workshop was how can technology not just be seen as a form of division, but also a form of connection and intimacy? And how does it permit us to exist in ways that we could never exist in the real world? So I feel like a lot of my work was actually anticipating or kind of prophetic to this moment.
On your Insta profile, you publish a lot of writing. Recently, also some poems about the crisis and how you experience it. Would you like to read one out?
Yeah, totally. This is a poem that I wrote a few weeks ago that was in response to Donald Trump saying that the US would have done a good job if only 200,000 people died. And I was like, how do we speak about life in such big numbers without panicking? The people that I love, they are dying, but there are no funerals, so I shelter this heart in place, read stories of a woman's corpse decomposed in her apartment, deserted nursing homes, parking lots chock full of sleeping bags, empty hotels across the block, pay raises for prisoners to dig the graves, hide the evidence. The opposite of a eulogy is a presidential address. The test results are in. This is the crude calculus of a country that consecrates capital over compassion. I wonder, is grief possible in a language that sanctions someone to call 200,000 people dying a good job? In order to die, there has to be consensus that the body was once, in fact, alive. I wonder if these people that I love, if they were ever considered alive. Here, where worth is commensurate with work, policy is a sanitized death sentence. Dignity is the antithesis of politics. Can we use the same tongue to mourn when they use it to murder?
So what is your feeling right now? Do people really take the time to mourn right now in this whole situation?
I think that they don't. And I think that's not their fault. It's because we live in a world that doesn't teach us how to grieve or how to feel our pain and the pain of other people, but instead teaches us how to disassociate and to compartmentalize so that we can be functional. And I think that the problem is that when we don't process grief in the moment, it can become rage and self-hatred later. So I'm very worried that there is a lot of backlash against women and trans and queer people right now, because we've always been very convenient repositories and scapegoats for unprocessed grief of straight cis people. And I also feel like after quarantine times, we're going to see an increase in violence in all forms, because people are not well and are going to take that out on other people. And so I actually view processing grief as an anti-violence mechanism. And a lot of people don't understand when I say that, but the truth is people cause harm because they feel hurt. And a lot of times that's because of unprocessed trauma. And I believe like a transformative strategy doesn't just see the symptoms, it sees the root causes. And the root causes of so much anguish and inequality and injustice in this world is unprocessed trauma. And I think that this is something that especially queer artists have been pushing for a very long time, which is, I want to redirect the focus away from my brilliance and my fabulosity towards their unprocessed trauma. That queer rights is not about my empowerment, but their disempowerment. Moving the focus away from us as some kind of spectacular subjects to actually saying, this is what healed trauma looks like. Like so many times people look at me and they're like, why do you even dress like that? Why do you look like that? That's ridiculous. And I'm like, babes, I healed myself from gender trauma. And this is what freedom looks like. I don't feel the need to be or look like anything for other people. And you're mistaking this as the pathology. But the real pathology is having to contort yourself into other people's projections and fantasies of what you should be.
Alok, as a gender non-conforming artist and queer activist of color, you worry a lot about the situation of queer people of color, especially transgender and non-binary persons. Over the last few weeks, I read a few articles and had a lot of discussions actually about the question of whether or not this group is especially affected by the pandemic. And very often people argue that the virus does not discriminate, that it doesn't make a difference between race, color, gender, or social status, and that queer or non-white people are not exposed to a greater risk than anyone else. And even I read comments on the internet where people spoke of self-pity and narcissism on the side of the stigmatized communities in this special time. How would you respond to these comments?
I want to unequivocally state that racism and transphobia deeply affect people's experiences with this virus, without a doubt. The data coming out of places like Chicago is that it's 80% of people who are dying are Black, and that in cities like Milwaukee, it can be up to 100%. That the majority of deaths right now are low-income Black and Latinx people in this country. And the reason for that is not because these communities are somehow inferior, but rather because of systematic racism, like environmental racism, the dumping of pollutants into people's neighborhoods so that they have asthma or their lungs are compromised, or the fact that the majority of essential workers in the United States are migrants and Black people. And so these are the people who are actually outside running this country as farm workers, as delivery workers, as grocery tellers. So they're more exposed to the virus. This is especially the case for nurses, of whom a large percentage of the nurses in the United States are Black and migrant third world women. Then on top of this, you have undocumented people having to work double or triply hard because they're not entitled to any of the benefits that are coming right now from the government and can't even go to hospitals in this country without fear of being deported. So what happens is that structural inequalities in the healthcare system are determining who has access to testing, who has access to ventilators, who has access to even go to the hospital. Then, when communities that are oppressed go to the hospital, they're often not believed for their symptoms. So in the United States, a relic of racism from slavery is that many people believe that Black people are not capable of experiencing pain and that they somehow are stronger than they are articulating themselves. This leads to an incredible rate of maternity mortality, that many Black persons die while giving birth because when they tell their doctors, I'm in pain or something's going on, they're disbelieved. And this is now happening where a lot of Black and racialized people are going to the medical system and saying, I have symptoms, and people will be like, I don't believe you, and they get turned away. And what we're finding is that tests in this country are being only made available to white rich people. I just read an article about how in Italy, this is happening the world over, how in Italy there's a billionaire kind of colony where billionaires are waiting this out, where they have their own private doctor who tests them repeatedly, right? So it's as if people were waiting for a virus to justify their post-racialism and post-sexism and to pretend that we're all one. We're not. And of course the virus doesn't care about race or gender, but we are attributing race and gender to it. Notice how people are calling this the Chinese virus and what that's done to Asian American people. I just wrote a poem a few weeks about this, but 6 hours from where I am right now, a Burmese man was stabbed while going grocery shopping, and his 2-year-old and 6-year-old children were stabbed as well because the guy said they were going to affect us with coronavirus. People are using the virus to justify their pre-existent xenophobia and anti-migrant sentiment against Asian people across the world. Many of my East Asian friends are afraid of even taking walks outside because people are getting trash thrown at them or spit at them or physically assaulted. And people are going to deny that's happening because this is what the media has always done. It erases hate violence, and then it blames other people for the violence that they're experiencing. And as this comes to queer and trans people, of course queer and trans people are disproportionately affected because many of us are having to shelter in place in abusive situations where we're more likely to experience intimate partner violence, domestic violence, familial violence, and hate violence. I'm getting reports, especially from young queers in the United States, who are now stuck with their parents who are physically and sexually abusing them, and that we don't have any resources to get these young people out because where do they go? That homeless shelters are not taking in other people. Queer and trans people are more likely to experience homelessness, and homelessness makes you more likely to be exposed to the virus. Then on top of this, 3 trans women have been murdered during shutdown in the United States. One of these trans women, a Black trans woman in North Carolina, was shot in an ambulance after she was seeking help for a medical condition. When trans women and trans feminine people go to the doctor's office in this country, especially in rural areas and in southern areas, we are sexually assaulted often by nurse and by doctors. We often are denied treatment because people make fun of us and misgender us while we're there. Something like 25% of trans people are misgendered and misnamed when they're in hospital settings. So many of us don't actually pursue healthcare because many of us have had negative experiences in doctor's offices. Then on top of that, we forget that trans people are precarious workers, that actually trans people in the United States are 4 times more likely to be unemployed, and that often 40% of trans people have an income of less than $10,000 US. So when people are getting laid off of jobs and losing economic opportunities, that is disproportionately going to affect trans people, making us in higher positions of poverty. This is especially the case for trans women and trans feminine people. Many of us live in informal economies, doing sex work or other forms of economies that are now impossible. I'm connected to a lot of grassroots trans groups in South Asia and India. And what I'm finding for many people is that trans women in India are being blamed as the culprit for spreading the virus. So what they're saying is it's Muslims people's fault, it's Hijra people's fault, stay away from these people. And so what's happening is that Hijra communities across South Asia are experiencing starvation and dying because the government isn't paying them anything. They're homeless, they have nowhere to be. They're seen as a potential contagion and they're unable to do sex work. So what happens is that if we don't have relief efforts that are specified to minority groups, those groups fall beneath the cracks. And that's why I take leadership from a state government in Kerala, where my family is from, where they actually had a program specifically to provide food and shelter to transgender persons. And that's one of the few initiatives across the world. I mean, what we're seeing in Latin America is that they're actually dividing shelter in place on the basis of the gender binary. So what they'll say is, oh, on Wednesdays, men are allowed to leave the house. On Fridays, women are allowed to leave the house. And what's happening is that when trans people leave the house, they're attacked because people see them as leaving the house on the wrong day than their gender, right? So there's so many examples I can continue to list, but what all of the evidence suggests is that racism, classism, transphobia are being exacerbated by this crisis and emphasized by this crisis. And that, to echo a lot of the work that's being done here, racism and transphobia are comorbidities to this crisis. That if you are trans, or if you are poor, or if you are Black, or if you are a person of color, you're more likely to experience severe symptoms. And it's really concerning to me that the government isn't tracking the data on the basis of race for this virus. After the AIDS crisis in the United States, a lot of AIDS activists said, it is predominantly Black people who are dying from this virus, and the media is only representing white gay people. But now what we know is that Black women are the most likely to contract and be infected by HIV and AIDS. And yet the CDC in this country still does not track the data on the basis of race. So that creates this illusion that all people are susceptible, even though through community reporting, we're showing that this virus is actually proving to be more lethal in communities who are immunocompromised because of structural racism.
In times of restricted right of physical contact and assembly, how can we continue as activists, and how can we gather, so to say, still take care for each other?
I think so many of us are still figuring this out, and I don't have the answers, but I have beautiful examples. So first, I've really been seeing people show up in mutual aid. And that looks like getting groceries for one another, getting prescription medicine for one another, talking on the phone when we're having a breakdown, strategizing about how we survive when we're having to cohabit with an abusive person in our life, democratizing resources, liberating our knowledge and our access to property to share among multiple people. And I think mutual aid is one of the most beautiful and political things that we can do. And I think we constantly underemphasize care work as not political because it's often gendered as feminine. So it's not seen as revolutionary. But I actually think care can be revolutionary. And right now, survival is a really important thing. And so making sure that everyone has medical resources, has a shelter, has a place to shelter, has food to do, that is political work. Then secondly, I've really been encouraged by the political education that is going on right now. So in the United States, someone named Naomi Klein, who's an incredible climate justice thinker, has been doing a series of webinars with another person named Kimberly Crenshaw, a Black feminist who coined the term intersectionality. And those webinars are having thousands of people all across the world tune in to hear talks from Angela Davis, to hear talks from local activists. And you're seeing politicization and political education like it's never been done. And that's another thing that is often underemphasized in social movements is political education. We assume that everyone gets it when that's totally not true. And we mistake our bubble as the world. And I think that now it's time to really share this information, teach people about how neoliberalism works and how the privatization of resources works and how they deserve a living wage, deserve affordable housing, deserve free healthcare. So building mass political consciousness. And then also, Another thing I've been really excited by is people assembling in protest while maintaining social distance and masks. So there's been a series of groups in the United States that are protesting Donald Trump by leaving fake body bags outside of the Trump buildings in this country, different hotels, apartment complexes. And if you notice their strategies, they're still maintaining 6 feet distance, they're wearing masks, and they're finding a way to do it. Then you see other protests of immigrant detention centers trying to free detainees in immigrant detention centers and free prisoners from prisons, with a bunch of people in their cars driving past honking and having signs outside of their car doors. So what you're seeing is the adaption of the protests to social distancing methods. They're not impossible. And anyone who says, like, you can't be outside at all is actually, we should read that as trying to stifle dissent and stifle protest, because there are ways to be outside in protest that maintain social distancing regulation.
You just mentioned the importance of political education. A lot of education programs now happen on the internet, but how can we reach those who don't have access?
Yes, that's a very big issue here, because a lot of schooling now is now online, and many young people don't have access to technology or even internet. I think the first thing we have to do is we have to challenge how the internet has become a privatized commodity and actually make it a public good. So we need to be supporting efforts that people are making forever to say, in the 21st century, the internet is like your utility bill. It's like having access to water or electricity, and it should not be seen as a private luxury. So I think it's about supporting efforts to disaggregate internet companies and to actually make them public resources versus private commodities. Second, it's about actually saying that as part of relief efforts, states need to provide technological equipment, not just food and housing, but also technological equipment, to make the argument that now, if you're expecting people to stay at home and to not go outside, all of the jobs that they can apply for are remote. So how are they supposed to even apply, let alone work them? So it's about saying that we need free technology given to the people. And there's more than enough money to do that. It shouldn't be relying on individual private companies to have a charity-based model. The charity-based model needs to be challenged right now, because that is just trying to fill in gaps. And I'm really bad at metaphors that have to do with ships, because I know nothing about ships, but trying to fill the leaks at the bottom of the ship. What we actually need is a whole new ship. So we need to think more ambitiously to say the government should be providing free technology to all people. Then I think the next step is really trying to think about surveillance online, because now that a lot of this information is being shared online, this makes us more susceptible to censorship, but also more susceptible to surveillance from people who might not agree with what we're saying and targeted, persecuted. So there's something happening called Zoom bombing, where people are infiltrating private Zoom sessions and sharing lewd and racist and misogynist content. This happened to me 2 weeks ago during one of my performances. Some white supremacists infiltrated my Zoom session, started screaming the N-word and saying, quote, kill all black people, quote. And it was deeply traumatizing for the participants, because some of them were black. And none of the moderators had prepared for this, because we thought that it was a private session that had a waiting list, that people had to email register, but the hackers found a way to get in. And after that experience, I found out this is happening to many political events, especially events that are about race and gender, that these trolls are targeting them specifically to instill fear so that we feel like we can't even assemble online. And that a lot of these social media companies have not taken this as a serious problem and put the onus on individual users to strategize on how to respond versus blocking it before it happens. So I think we also need more refined goals and asks around what privacy looks like on the internet, more data protection law, more threats to people who are actually using the internet as a way to espouse racism and sexism, that we actually are saying that this is a legitimate hate crime. Because in the United States, a lot of people will say, oh, it's just internet, it's just trolling. But we have all the data to show now how trolling leads to in-person violence and how trolling is experienced as a form of violence. So we need much more strategizing and development of policy around internet surveillance and hate online.
So we need digital safe spaces, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. Alok, in one of your interviews you gave last year, you said that being an artist means creating images of a world that you want. What are your images for a post-corona world? How do you imagine the world after the pandemic?
First, I've been really trying to create images of glamour inside, because oftentimes people see glamour as having to require other people seeing you and not something that you do for yourself. But for me, getting dressed is a form of meditation and spiritual practice. And I actually feel like now we really need to be returning to self-love and to self-nurture, because times are very desperate. There's a lot of grief and pain and anguish. And I want to model to people that it's okay to have a beautiful and intimate relationship with yourself. And a lot of people are going to dismiss that as what you were saying before about people dismissing, people talking about the need to focus on queer people as self-indulgent. They'll say, oh, you need to be focusing for the greater good. And for the greater good always becomes default gray masculine form. And femininity is constantly seen as selfish or superfluous. And I'm actually trying to create images of incredible glamour and beauty inside to show that, like, actually, I don't require external validation. And I also want to show visibly queer and gender nonconforming images, because I know that so many queer people are unable to express their genders right now, because they're in abusive institutions. And so I'm getting a lot of messages from people being like, I haven't been able to wear makeup in weeks, or I haven't been able to wear my chest binder, or I haven't been able to wear my clothes. And so I think that I need to create queer images that remind people who they are and of their beauty when they're facing a lot of invalidation. Then I want to create images of intimacy online. So one of the things that I did is I did a photo shoot with a Moscow-based photographer who was doing a project where she was taking portraits of people in quarantine via Zoom. And those photos were so important to me because it showed hope that someone like a photographer is finding ways to adapt her practice to what's happening right now. So I want to create hopeful images that show the possibility of connection, even amidst these times of social isolation. Then I want to create images of books. I've been reading a lot of political books and doing book reviews recently, because I'm trying to show people we can use this time to educate ourselves. And so I've been not just taking photos of myself, but taking photos of books and having books have their own digital life. And I really hope that this is a time that we really return to books, because I'm finding so much support in them, so much community in them. Books are my friends right now. So I just keep on amassing them and just reading them and feeling so much hope in them. And then finally, I want to create images of leisure. And I've never really done that before because, as you know, I work very hard and I'm a touring artist, which means I'm constantly on the go, moving. And now I'm having to sit with relaxing, and I don't know how to do that. Like, my first response is like to schedule every hour of my day with something. But what I'm learning actually is that relaxation is so key to just allow ourselves to decompress. And we've been mistaken to think that that self-pleasure is a form, once again, of self-indulgence. And I'm like, no, actually, let's just take naps and let's just like chill and just eat, and let's demonstrate that all those things that are guilty pleasures should not be guilty. They're just pleasures.
Coming back to the books, do you have any recommendations?
I have so many recommendations, and it's a good thing I'm underneath my bookshelf right now because I can show them. There's an incredible poet named Ross Gay, and he has a book called The Book of Delights. And then his other book is called Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude. And what I love about Ross Gay is he writes about how to have joy during times of despair. And he basically is committed to saying, we can both acknowledge how horrible things are while not losing touch with our joy. And he differentiates joy from happiness because he says happiness is conditional on what's happening in the world, whereas joy is just a fundamental state of being. And how we access that fundamental state of being is learning how to notice delight in places that we've been taught are not delightful. So he's really committed to how do we recalibrate things that we see as normal or basic as being rich with life. So he writes particularly about nature and how to look at flowers and be continually overwhelmed by the beauty of nature and how to anchor ourselves in the transformative possibility of nature, that seasons come and go, that plants seed and then die, and to find a kind of joy in that cycle of life. And what I really appreciate about Ross Gay is that when you listen to him, I listen to every interview, every podcast, you can feel the deep delight in his voice. He is truly someone who has found a way to access internal peace despite what's happening in the world. And I'm learning so much from him.
Alok, it was great to talk to you today. I'm already looking forward to welcome you back live on stage as soon as we are allowed to come together again. But before we close for today, I would like to ask you to read another poem for us.
Sure. I can't wait to come back to Copenhagen. Always one of my favorite places in the world. This is a poem I wrote called A New Unit of Measure. And I wrote it after I left my house for the first time in weeks to go to the post office. And at the post office, I just felt the whole new world, that everyone was wearing masks. We had to stand 6 feet apart. And this was kind of my response to that. A new unit of measure. I left my house for the first time in weeks to mail a package. At the post office, there were yellow pieces of tape on the floor to mark where we should stand. That distance between us felt occupied. What became evident was that the new unit of measure is no longer the foot, it is the casket. Maintain at least one casket distance from each other. Here are some other examples of what that could look like going forward. How many caskets does it take to get home? How many caskets fit in the living room? How many caskets are worth making people vote outside? How many caskets can we get away with to reopen the economy? How many caskets to indict an administration? My apologies. The Department of Justice has requested the removal of the last example from further circulation. The mail personnel, they have the sort of plastic shield in front of them that seemed more impromptu than anything. I appreciated the effort. It was honest, the physical embodiment of we're figuring it out. And these days, honesty is not considered an essential good, but denial is. Our prescription medicine, mass marketed, mass produced, mass supplied. Don't worry, we have a surplus of it, such that even if every factory shuts down, we will be able to feed our children. It is both our healthcare and retirement plan. We know it better, I think, than we know ourselves. We do not live in the present, we live in the promise. After all, this is the promised land, where power is conferred not from the ability to deliver, but rather from the ability to promise delivery. This distinction is both as vital and as scarce as a face mask. We mistake that sensation of a rug being pulled beneath our feet as merely the delight, discomfort, of riding a magic carpet. We blame ourselves when we fall from the sky, pay the medical cost for the rest of our lives, and after our death, remain in gratitude for at least a moment, having felt, moved. I suppose the better unit of measurement would be the promise. How many promises does it take to turn a crisis into a campaign strategy? How many promises does it take to make the coffin its fault, not their misdoing? How many promises does it take to dig a coffin so deep we forget about it. How many promises does it take to prop up a coffin, use it as a presidential lectern, congratulate ourselves as we have no protective gear for the doctors, no ventilators for the patients, no tests for the people, no money for the tenants, no benefits for the workers, no food for the hungry, just promises, just promises, just promises for a population with the highest international death toll in the most, quote, developed country in the world. Just promises, just promises, just promises. There is no discrepancy here. And the land of promise, we measure the integrity of a sentence by how it makes us feel, not what it buries beneath it.
Thank you, Alok. And please stay healthy and let's stay in touch.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a good day. Bye. Mom, 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 mom